I just checked that you're hearing me. Is the microphone spreading the message? Good, excellent. I thought I'd begin with a statement of Darwin that to some of you might possibly come as a surprise. We're all used, I think, to the argument that Darwin took God out of nature. But in the large book he was working on in the late 1850s, his big species book on natural selection, of which The Origin of Species was a rather rushed summary, Darwin felt it necessary to define exactly what he did mean by nature. And this is what is rather interesting. By nature, says Darwin, I mean the laws ordained by God to govern the universe. And I find that interesting for several reasons. It shows that Darwin was still using theological language in the late 1850s, despite popular belief concerning Darwin's destruction of natural theology. The language there at least preserves a link between nature and God. And his definition of nature is, I think, another reminder that what was at stake in controversies of his day was not simply competing ideas about nature, but the very meaning of the word. And I'd like to illustrate that by reference to the great Swiss naturalist, Louis Agassiz, who arrived at Harvard in 1846, soon to become their Harvard professor of geology and zoology. And we learned that Agassiz was given a huge and welcoming reception when he arrived, and scholars have wondered in part why that was. And it seems to have been because of the particular interpretation he gave to living forms. Because Agassiz's understanding of nature was a philosophy of nature that we might call Platonist, and it struck a chord with the religious ideals of many in the college. Agassiz had no time for theories of evolution that involved material connections between species. Rather, he saw in the fossil record evidence of progressive creation as one epoch succeeded another. Putting it slightly differently, living things were the instantiation of ideas from the mind of the creator. And he put it like this on one occasion: there will be no scientific evidence of God's working in nature until naturalists have shown that the whole creation is the expression of thought and not the product of physical agents. Now, note that phrase, nature as the expression of thought, because Agassiz was not alone in that view. In England, Richard Owen also ascribed the common bone structures of the vertebrates to an archetypal idea in the mind of God. Now, I always like to talk about Richard Owen because he was born in Lancaster, which is where I spent much of my life. Some of you may know it was Richard Owen who actually invented dinosaurs, or rather gave them that name. And here you see Owen riding to fame on the back of a megatherium. He used to design dinosaurs, place them around eminent structures around London. People would collide with them, have nightmares afterwards. But at one conference in London, the dinosaur on display was this rather ugly looking beast. If you look very closely, you see a group of men there dining. And heading the table, appropriately, is Richard Owen. And I always feel this is the first genuine example of a dinosaur diner. But that's not really the point. The real point is something else, which is that Owen had this idea that all vertebrates were modelled on a single structure, which you see at the top of that slide. All vertebrates are modelled on that. And it's as if creation, as if nature, is a kind of process, an unfolding of a series of instantiations of that archetype. during Agassiz's tenure at Harvard, Charles Darwin, whom we recognise there, published his Origin of Species. And here was a quite different account of the unity of form. For Darwin, as you know, it was the consequence of a historical process in which species were related by common descent. And the clash with that previous picture of nature I was describing was transparent. Whereas Agassiz proclaimed that the intervention of a creator is displayed in every stage of the history of the world, Darwin's mechanism of natural selection required no such intervention. There was a greater autonomy in Darwin's conception of nature than in that of Agassiz or of Richard Owen. And Agassiz communicated his verdict on Darwin to Asa Gray, who was professor of botany at Harvard. This says Agassiz on Darwin: "Mr. Darwin's work is poor, very poor." A few years later, a scientific meeting was held in Boston at which both Agassiz and the British physicist John Tyndall were present. And Tyndall leaves a poignant account of a scene that we might say marks the passing of an age. This is Tyndall on the Boston scientific meeting. "Rising from luncheon, we all halted, as if by common consent, in front of a window. And we continued a discussion which had been started at table. The maple was in its autumn glory, and the exquisite beauty of the scene seemed, in my case, to interpenetrate the intellectual action. Earnestly, almost sadly, Agassiz turned and said to the gentleman standing round, 'I confess that I was not prepared to see Darwin's theory received as it has been by the best intellects of our time. Its success is greater than I could have thought possible.'" To speak of the passing of an age does, I think, capture something of the Darwinian impact, but it also misses a vital element. And that is the remarkable diversity of the religious response. Asa Gray, to whom Agassiz confided his poor opinion of Darwin, Gray took a very different view, positively promoting the theory of natural selection, claiming even, now this is why it's interesting, claiming that it had theological advantages. Darwin's theory underlined the unity of the human races. Homo sapiens was a single species. All human beings had the same common ancestor. Interestingly, Agassiz did not take that view and thought different races had separate origins. Now, the reason this is interesting is that Darwin's work hit the scene, of course, when slavery was very much a political issue and there had been anti-slavery campaigns for a long time. Put it very crudely, Asa Gray welcomed Darwin's theory because it actually gave biological support to an abolitionist cause. And interestingly, one of the best books that's come out so far in Darwin's anniversary year touches on this very theme. James Moore and Adrian Desmond have published a book with the title Darwin's Sacred Cause. And their argument is that Darwin's theory of human origin was in its formation driven by a moral imperative, which was to give biological justification to an anti-slavery position. Moral purpose behind the very formation of the theory of evolution. Well, Jim's talking about his book in the museum here in Oxford in a couple of weeks' time, so do look out for that. Gray felt that Darwin's theory helped the theologians in another respect on their most difficult problem, the problem of suffering. Gray argued that if competition in a struggle for existence is the motor of evolution, then there's perhaps a sense in which the concomitant suffering is a precondition of the very possibility of our existence. Without the struggle for existence, no innovation, no progress, ultimately no human being. Gray even proposed to Darwin that the variations on which natural selection worked could be said to be under the control of providence. Well, now we could say much more, of course, about the diversity of the response to Darwin, but my brief today was to focus more sharply on Darwin himself, and that's what I propose to do. Now, Darwin had, of course, wondered and worried how his theory might be received. To one of his correspondents just before publication, he writes, "God knows what the public will think." To admit the mutability of species had been like confessing to a murder. Darwin knew, of course, that his book was likely to have a polarizing effect. Here in Oxford, Disraeli once stood up and said, "It seems, gentlemen, that we are now either on the side of the apes or on the side of the angels. As for me, I am on the side of the angels." And the next day, that appeared in the popular press. The threat to human dignity that so worried Samuel Wilberforce, the Bishop of Oxford, was often captured in cartoons, and one of my favourites has always been this one. One monkey says to the other, "Cut my tail off quick, Tim. I can't wait to take my true place in society." Bruising attacks from members of the clergy made Darwin say, or almost say, that those who oppose my theory by snarling and baring their teeth only confirm thereby their canine origin. And his grievance was that his theory was so often judged for its supposed theological implications rather than for the quality of his science. And one has to have enormous sympathy with him, I think, in that respect. Contrary to modern creationist rhetoric, Darwin was never an atheist in the sense of denying the existence of God. And those are almost his own words. In the successive editions of The Origin, Darwin continued to refer to a creator who, in his own words, creates through laws. Now, interpreting Darwin's remarks about God or about a creator is not, however, such a straightforward matter. And as I get a little deeper into this talk, I'd just like to indicate three or four issues which I think any historian has to face when interpreting Darwin's own remarks about nature and particularly about God. And there's one very simple reason why you can't say what Darwin believed about God, because his views changed over time. As I think many of you will know, he went to Cambridge to study to become an Anglican priest. By the time he wrote The Origin of Species, he had deserted Christianity, but still, I believe, subscribed to a deistic position. That belief in the God who had ordained the laws of nature. In old age, he becomes, again by his own admission, increasingly agnostic. So that's a very crude kind of image of a trajectory, but it means you cannot simply say, in a timeless sense, what Darwin believed about God. Secondly, and I think this makes the point more forcefully, even during one and the same period, Darwin admitted that his beliefs often fluctuate. My beliefs often fluctuate. When referring to himself as an agnostic in May 1879, he would add the caveat, "An agnostic fits my state of mind, but not always." At other times, he would say quite explicitly that he deserved to be called a theist. He was, if you like, a now and then believer. Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, belief in God was still quite strong for him. Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays, it receded. So we're dealing here with a rather complex matter. And if you think you can somehow compress Darwin's ideas about God into sound bites, then I'm afraid you'll certainly get it wrong. Darwin sometimes said that he couldn't believe this wonderful universe could possibly be the result of chance alone. And such remarks have lent themselves to apologetic exploitation. But to appropriate them in that way misses the nuance that Darwin so often inserted. He could not believe that the universe is the result of chance, but nor could he look at the structures of living organisms and see in them the product of design. As he disarmingly wrote to Asa Gray, "I am in a hopeless muddle." Or on another occasion, "I am in thick mud." In other words, on the really big questions, he didn't pretend to have all the answers. Finally, there is a complication that stems from the privacy of religious belief. Darwin once reproached an inquirer by saying that he couldn't see why his beliefs should be of concern to anyone but himself. Well, in 2009, of course, Darwin's beliefs seemed to be of interest to everybody. His public remarks were sometimes deliberately calculated to give minimal offence, and this is the source of the problem, the source of the ambiguity. In contrast to some of Darwin's modern disciples, he did not believe that religious beliefs, however distasteful they might be to him, should be confronted head on. But the consequence is a frustrating degree of ambiguity in Darwin's references to the deity. So that's a little list of complications, which mean that we have to place his statements very carefully in the context in which they are made. Having said that, let's move forward now and look at some of the formative experiences for Darwin's views on nature and God. The story of how his science was shaped by his experiences on the five-year voyage of HMS Beagle has been told many times, and so brilliantly that I'm not going to repeat it here, but I do want to pick out three encounters that shaped Darwin's perceptions of nature and which also, I think, left a permanent mark on his religious outlook. And the first of these encounters on the Beagle voyage was with the beauty of a virginal nature. He'd longed to travel. He'd read the travel writings of Alexander von Humboldt. The lure of the Brazilian rainforest exerted a magnetic attraction on him. And when Darwin finally arrived in Brazil and saw scenes like this, they cast a spell on what was, I think, a genuinely romantic sensibility. But it's during the voyage that Darwin gave up the idea of being a clergyman. And I think in his response to scenes like this, you may begin to hear the stirrings of a surrogate religion, a religion of nature, perhaps, rather than a religion directed personally towards the deity. When he finally arrived and saw scenes like that, he recorded his experience in almost ecstatic language. "Twiners entwining twiners, tresses like hair, beautiful Lepidoptera. Silence. Hosanna. Very interesting graduation of his language there to describe the scene. But as I'm suggesting, there is the waning, perhaps, of a commitment to a Christian faith, which had been, I think, perfectly conventional and orthodox while he was in Cambridge. Secondly, on the voyage, Darwin encounters nature in the raw. He encounters that struggle for existence that was to play such a crucial role in his theory of natural selection. The world of nature that Darwin encountered in South America was not the happy world that William Paley had described in his Natural Theology. I think, as many of you will know, Paley constructed an argument for God's existence based on the wonderful adaptations and contrivances in living systems. So the woodpecker's beak is wonderfully contrived for getting insects out of the bark, or the camel's hump is wonderful if the camel wants to voyage across the desert. That kind of design argument, as Richard Dawkins points out, was sabotaged by the mature Darwinian theory. And perhaps we can smile when we read Paley today and find that the human epiglottis is so wonderfully designed that no alderman has ever choked at a feast. It's rather difficult to believe that Christianity should rest on arguments of this kind. What I think I'm suggesting here is that way of looking at nature gradually receded with Darwin on the voyage. Let me just give you a few examples of the struggle in nature that Darwin witnessed. This is nature red in tooth and claw on the grand scale. You can just see in the very top of the picture, well, actually, everywhere, the giant condors preying on young cattle. And it's not just animals and birds preying off each other. There was a colonial struggle that Darwin encountered in Argentina, where the native Indians were being challenged and exterminated by the forces of General Rosas there. The instability, the violence of nature extending to human populations, this creates a vivid impression with Darwin. He encounters earthquakes. At Concepcion, the cathedral had just been shattered. It's another kind of instability. And Darwin writes home after witnessing that particular scene and said, "I've been led to think, what would our natural theology have been like if England had been subject to earthquakes and volcanoes?" Nature is not a vicarage garden. It certainly isn't when you visit South America, and particularly when you go right down to the southern tip, the Tierra del Fuego, where the natives were struggling against one of the most inhospitable climes in the world. Now, Darwin's encounter with the natives of the Tierra del Fuego, just for a moment, deserves special consideration. Darwin would eventually ask whether our ancestors were men like these. And his interest in them stemmed in part from an evangelical experiment that was taking place before his eyes. Thank you, Peter. On an earlier visit to South America, Captain Fitzroy of the Beagle had captured some Fuegians, taken them back to England, dressed them up, Christianized them, baptized them. One was christened York Minster. And the idea was that they would go back to their own people, proselytized, and spread the good news of Christianity to their own kind. And here are these Christianized Fuegians, who do look a little different from the figure we saw a moment ago. And Darwin is deeply intrigued to find out what happens to these youngsters when they go back to their own kind. There was a missionary on board ship to accompany them. And I have to say, the experiment ended in disaster. and the missionary had to flee for his life. Darwin had been told by them on the ship that he should be very careful if he went ashore, because the Fuegians were cannibals, and they would eat their women rather than their dogs. Not that Darwin was a woman, of course, but the point that was said, and I'm sure it has to be partly tongue-in-cheek, they ate their women rather than their dogs because the dogs were at least useful. Well, I'm sorry for that political incorrectness, but it's not my own. It did, however, raise a very significant question for Darwin about what we might call the veneer of civilization. Were our ancestors like that previous figure? How thin is the veneer of civilization? But more crucially, looking at these Fuegians, Darwin considered a problem that he thought about before he left England. And it's the question whether there is some absolute criterion that enables you to differentiate between humans and animals. And his cousin, Hensley Wedgwood, had told him that there is. And that crucial criterion is that all human beings have an innate sense of God, and animals do not. And what struck Darwin observing the Fuegians, and he observed the same in Australia when studying the Aborigines there, he came to the conclusion that these primitive human beings did not, in fact, have an innate sense of God. They didn't appear to have a religious ritual of worship, and nor did they even have a word for God in their vocabulary. Now, this recognition that a sense of God is not uniformly distributed informed Darwin's thinking about religion for the rest of his life, not least because there is an obvious question. Why is it that some societies have religious beliefs and others do not? Is it a biological matter or is it a socio-cultural matter? And that's still a question we're debating today. Now, I'd like to move on to talk now about a theological question that grows out of Darwin's theory of nature. A question about God emerges from what he has to say about nature. And this is a rather different point from the one about natural law that I've been stressing hitherto. Darwin's study of variation and his conception of natural selection were products of the 2 years that followed his return to England in 1836. As with Alfred Russel Wallace later, the reading of Malthus's essay on population triggered the realization that in a fiercely competitive struggle, favorable variations would tend to be preserved, unfavorable ones destroyed. And that was the germ of the theory that he subsequently developed. Well, you know that, of course. But Darwin's use of the phrase natural selection actually raised a theological question. The metaphor of selection was substantiated by reference to the role of human breeders as they selected the characteristics they wished to enhance in cattle or in dogs or in pigeons. And if domestic breeders could effect such changes in a short span of time, how much more might not nature achieve, given eons of time? Now, pigeons in particular gave a boost to Darwin's rhetoric in The Origin of Species. You may not think of Darwin as a pigeon fancier, but he moved among them, in a sense, conferring a degree of social dignity on their practices. And Darwin's rhetoric in The Origin of Species makes particular reference to pigeons because he says that unless he knew that all the varieties produced by pigeon fanciers derived from the common rock pigeon, even a well-trained ornithologist would be inclined to categorize them as separate species. So there you are. Are they varieties or are they separate species? Here, however, is the question. If human intelligence intervenes in the practices of the domestic breeder, as it clearly does, might there not, by analogy, be a selector with a capital S working through natural processes. And for some of Darwin's contemporaries, this seemed a reasonable enough inference, and for them it took the sting out of the theory. But it was not Darwin's view. To postulate a selector other than the course of nature was, as far as he was concerned, to miss the point. Conjuring up the image of God as a kind of micromanager of the evolutionary process. And that was an image that Darwin steadfastly resisted. So there is, I think, the interesting question, why did he resist that sort of image? It seems obvious to me that his resistance has something to do with his private renunciation of the Christian faith. But then a further question arises. What precisely was the relationship between the gains Darwin made in science and the loss of that Christian faith? Now, here I should say that in the literature we often find one of two extreme positions. It's either argued that it was Darwin's science that destroyed his faith, or the other extreme, it was his loss of faith that made possible his radical science. E.O. Wilson is one recent commentator who presents the choice in those rather stark terms. So I just quote from Wilson, because this is a view I'm going to contest in a moment. The great naturalist did not abandon Abrahamic and other religious dogmas because of his discovery of evolution by natural selection, as one might reasonably suppose. The reverse occurred. The shedding of blind faith gave him the intellectual fearlessness to explore human evolution wherever logic and evidence took him. Well, we could all cavil perhaps about that phrase, blind faith. But my question is, are these two the only alternatives? Because my own view is that a more subtle analysis is necessary. While it is largely true that Darwin's loss of faith was not occasioned by his science, there were at the very least indirect connections. Even before his marriage to Emma, she worried that the critical, skeptical mentality necessary for constructive science would corrode his faith. And I think she was very prescient in that respect. And that second opinion preferred by E.O. Wilson cannot be entirely correct, because Darwin was apparently still a Christian in the early 1840s when the first substantial draft of his theory was already entrusted to Emma for publication in the event of his death. Another problem with that structuring of the alternatives that we've seen in Wilson is that some of Darwin's deepest reflections involved both scientific and religious considerations simultaneously. For example, his science highlighted the theological problem of pain and suffering. And he once wrote that the existence of so much pain and suffering in the world seemed to him one of the strongest arguments against belief in a beneficent deity. But he continues, it accords well with my theory of natural selection. So the science and the theology are operating in the same sentence in the context of talking about suffering. And in Darwin's conception of nature, one has to add that there had to be room for what he called the horribly cruel and wasteful works of nature. Let's think a little bit more deeply about Darwin's loss of faith. I would argue that his science did, to a degree, corrode that earlier commitment to Christianity, and for the following reasons. The quality of the historical evidence commonly adduced for the miracles and divinity of Christ, Darwin eventually considered poor, compared with the stringent evidential support required of a scientific theory. So that issue is, I think, a real one for him. Secondly, reports of miracles for him have been rendered increasingly suspect because of advances in scientific understanding, to which he himself was obviously contributing. As he puts it in his autobiography, the more we know of the fixed laws of nature, the more incredible do miracles become. So that, again, is an issue. Thirdly, although Darwin was ignorant of the causes of variation, he was convinced that their appearance was random. Many variations were disadvantaged for the organism, and even those that turned out to be advantageous could hardly be said to have been produced with their prospective use in mind. And it's on that point that Darwin and Asa Gray parted company. Gray's advice to Darwin was that until such time as the cause of variation was understood, it would be wise to ascribe it to providence. That's one reason why Gray felt no dissonance between natural selection and natural theology. He could interpret the variations as having been led in propitious directions. Darwin dissented. He argues that because a builder happens to use a pile of available stones to build a house, it in no way follows that those stones had come into being and deposited in that place in order that the house could be built. In other words, there's a sense in which Darwin is reading purposiveness out of the story of evolution, and Gray has to concede that he has no answer, except to say, and I think there's a lesson here for some, except to say that the perception of design is ultimately a matter of faith. Now, I just said that purposiveness was read out of the story, but even that requires important qualification. In the Cambridge Companion to The Origin of Species, to which Peter kindly referred and which has just been published, there's a wonderful essay by Robert Richards from the University of Chicago, arguing that as Darwin worked on his theory of evolution, there was yet another sense of moral purpose than the anti-slavery running through the argument. And this is simply to say for Darwin that there is a kind of overriding purpose in evolution to create what he calls the higher animals, which represent the highest good that we can conceive. And that squares, I think, perfectly with what T.H. Huxley had to say when he referred to a higher teleology working, as it were, through nature than the rather narrow teleology we associate with William Paley. So we're dealing again with a rather complex matter here. Darwin's science did contribute to his agnosticism in one further respect. I've already referred to his conviction that the universe as a whole could not be the product of chance. But in another of his captivating nuances, he would add that there were reasons why he should not trust even his own convictions. And this is that if the human mind is the product of evolution, what guarantees are there that it's equipped to deal with such metaphysical and theological niceties? Unlike other agnostics, Darwin had convictions. Agnostics are not supposed to have convictions. But Darwin's brand of agnosticism is very subtle, because having laid out his convictions, he then says, but why should I accept them? Why should I believe my own? And this is a very subtle form of agnosticism, I think, and raises some big epistemological problems arising from mental evolution. Okay, so I do think Darwin's science is effective in a certain sense, several senses, in corroding his faith and leading to agnosticism. But, having said all that, I would say that it's the existential grounds of religious doubt that are probably the most significant. Darwin, like many Victorian intellectuals, revolted against the Christian doctrine of eternal damnation as it was preached at the time. Because if that doctrine were true, his grandfather, his father, his brother, Erasmus, were all destined for eternal damnation because they were free thinkers, or in the case of Erasmus Darwin, an out-and-out atheist. So Darwin writes in what I think was his most astringent comment about Christianity, "I cannot see why anybody should even wish Christianity to be true. This doctrine is a damnable doctrine." So if we're looking specifically for why he rejects a Christian theism, then I think we have to look at considerations of that kind. We've already seen how he was affected by the realization that an innate sense of God was not universal. As he experienced and studied other cultures, he found it impossible to accept the idea of a unique revelation. He complains of the ignorance of the biblical writings, and he's worried about what he sees as an incongruous relationship between the New and the Old Testament. As James Moore has brilliantly shown, Darwin was deeply affected by the death, early in 1851, of his 10-year-old daughter, Annie. And the letters that passed between Charles and Emma, as Annie gradually lost her private battle for existence, are deeply moving. And I do urge you, have a look at the volume of Darwin's correspondence for early 1851. And I would defy you not to shed tears when you read those letters. In distress and under duress, Darwin still invoked the name of God in his most intimate correspondence. But the loss of so innocent a child and his favourite left a terrible scar. Was this not the problem of pain and suffering? Justice even writ large. And finally, in one of Darwin's letters to Asa Gray, we find another consideration that certainly cannot be counted as scientific, but it's a consideration, I think, common to us all. At least we all must think about it. Darwin puts a question to Gray. If a man stands under a tree and is struck by lightning, do you believe, and I really would like to know, do you believe that that man was designedly struck by lightning at that moment? If on a summer night a swallow swallows a particular gnat, do you believe, and I really should like to know, that it was designed that that particular swallow should swallow that particular gnat at that particular moment? Many do believe this, says Darwin, but I cannot. And what I'm suggesting here is that Darwin's sensitivity to the particularities, the contingencies, the accidents of both human and non-human life, the absence, if you like, of any intelligible pattern, made it very difficult for him to believe in providence. Very difficult, if not impossible. I think I'm going to stop there, because we would, I think, value a bit of time for questions. There's much more I could say about Darwin's legacy, and much also about what I think Christians still have to learn from him in the context of how to conduct themselves in a controversy. And my great sadness, as I'm sure it is for many of you, is that we have a polarization in the world today between religious fundamentalists of various stripes on the one hand and scientific dogmatists of a similar kind of persuasion, one would have to say, on the other. And the way that battle is fought seems to me to be in large measure a betrayal of the finer sentiments that we certainly find in Darwin himself, because he never wished to impose his own views on anybody else. And if he had a creed at the end of his life, it's encapsulated in one of his private letters where he says, "Let each man and woman hope and believe what they can." thank you for listening so patiently.